It may be Australia's biggest bank raid.
For decades, the bank has secured priceless antiques and numerous family heirlooms.
A case police found almost impossible to crack.
They knew months in advance that was the time they were going to strike.
Investigative reporter Adam Shand follows the evidence.
What happened when they tried to get into the main vault?
They burned a hole in the top of the thermic lamp, which is pretty advanced stuff.
And we reveal the mastermind behind the job.
So was he the one that got away?
It was New Year's Eve 1987, and Sydney siders were partying hard to celebrate the milestone of Australia's bicentennial. 1988. But while the drinks flowed, a gang of thieves was hard at work on an audacious bank job in the city's Chinatown district. The New Year holiday ran from Friday to Monday, so the heist wasn't discovered until the Monday morning when bank employees arrived for work. And the press, they didn't hear about it until the Tuesday. What was your first inkling of what had happened?
I remember that Tuesday. It was just a very slow day. When you work for a commercial television network at that time, we were extremely competitive. I got a quiet phone call and I disappeared. And then about 10 minutes later, other phone calls. And then about half an hour later, there's all the journos and we're all standing out the front of the National Australia Bank down at the Haymarket.
The Chinatown branch of the National Australia Bank was an imposing structure. But it was soon clear the bank's defences had been breached.
Today, the bank said it was unable to estimate the value of the weekend haul.
You start to work the contacts. What are you learning about the case?
My contact said explosives had been used. It was a big robbery, and we're still learning about it. What gave us the inkling that it was big is that there were many, many cars from what they call the CIB, Criminal Investigation Branch. So that's how it started.
This morning, the locals in Sydney's Haymarket gave the bicentennial bank bust another name.
What did you call it?
Chino's Takeaway.
There was talk that the job was so long that they had to get a feed halfway through it and somebody went and got a Chinese meal, and that's how it became known as the Great Chinese Takeaway. Whether that's true or not, we'll never know. But we did know that there were many, many, many safety deposit boxes. 84, I think.
Yeah, right.
And we did know that there'd been a major attempt to blow up a safe.
One by one, members of the Chinese and other Asian communities arrived at the bank to find if their safety deposit boxes were still intact.
There you were, so open up.
Have you got all your money still there?
No, we don't have money in there.
Passport, money.
All gone?
Yeah.
Others took the news harder.
He lost everything.
So how did the gang break into the bank undetected?
My name is Kevin Parsons. In January 1988, I was the officer in charge of the Regional Crime Squad South.
Kevin, when you got to the scene, you could see their method of getting in and getting out.
Adjoining to the bank was a construction site, and they climbed up the scaffolding and then used a ladder to get up to a higher floor of the bank premises. One of the persons then walked down and opened the door on the first level to let the others in with the equipment. They lifted the roof of the lift, then went down into the vault area in the basement with the equipment.
Once in the basement, the gang used explosives to blow a hole into the vault housing the safety deposit boxes. Police believe they may have stayed on site for more than 24 hours, taking their time to clean out the boxes before exiting the same way they came in.
No doubt they would have had somebody keeping watch on the outside too.
The whole nation was soon asking the same question. How much did the thieves get away with?
Are we talking about millions of dollars, though, in the robbery?
No, we're not talking about millions of dollars, no.
Sir, if you don't know what was in the boxes, then how can you say millions of dollars aren't involved?
I can't say millions of dollars
aren't involved.
You did, yeah.
We are not close on a figure at this stage because it was only late yesterday afternoon that the first of the victims was spoken to.
For decades, the bank has secured priceless antiques and numerous family heirlooms. It's these items, according to Chinatown sources, that easily makes the robbery Australia's largest.
And perhaps it wasn't just cash and jewels that had been stolen.
Well, they're saying 20 million. I reckon they probably would have got more.
Do you? And anything else apart from money and possibly jewellery?
Oh, could be anything. Smack, cake, you know, all the drugs. Probably a lot would have been there.
Well, how do people come to deposit drugs in a safety deposit box in a bank?
Well, where's a safer place?
It's a good point. There's nowhere safer to hide the proceeds of a crime than in a bank. Sydney's Chinatown of the 1980s was a central hub for the importation and distribution of heroin. There were also illegal gambling dens, prostitution and extortion rackets controlled by the triad gangs. The National Crime Authority set up a joint task force with the Hong Kong police to try to smash the bamboo curtain in Chinatown. I sat down with crime historian Peter Hoisted to find out more about Asian crime networks. How much did we know about those in the 80s?
Well, not a lot. Look, you're dealing with two things first. So you're dealing with Chinese people who come to Australia and set up as immigrants. They're not necessarily criminals, but they have come from harsh regimes, totalitarian regimes, so they carry with them a mistrust of government and authority. So they are going to use this form of banking to secure their personal goods. Then organised crime groups operating in Sydney from Southeast Asia. They had developed smuggling routes, particularly of opium, illegal gaming within Chinatown and Sydney was very, very strong too. So in those private security boxes, we have a lot of black money and we have a lot of black goods.
Are they obliged to tell you what is actually in their safety deposit boxes?
No, they're not obliged to tell us that type of information.
Lead investigator Kevin Parsons was left banging his head against a great wall of silence.
We attempted to identify all the owners of the safety deposit boxes, but the difficulty was that a lot of the boxes were not correctly identified by an owner, and there seemed to be a reluctance from them to just inform us of exactly what the boxes had contained.
Well, you could be forgiven for saying to yourself, well, this is crooks robbing crooks.
I would agree with that.
Regardless, it was a major crime which had to be solved. And police suspected the work of an insider.
It's an inside job in regard to the fact that they had to have intimate details of the layout and the security system adopted by the bank.
Next, how the thieves got away with the loot.
Not much of a security guard.
Well, he didn't realise they'd entered from an upstairs floor and got a lift down into the vault area.
In 1988, while Sydney slept off its New Year's Eve hangover, a gang of brazen thieves stole an unknown quantity of cash and valuables from the Haymarket branch of the National Australia Bank. The raid was dubbed a Chinese takeaway.
The Haymarket Bank has now become the Haymarket Hotel. However, many of the bank's fittings remain. Downstairs, the old safety deposit chamber is now the Martini Bar. And the main vault is a prominent feature. It's a great pub for a New Year's Eve party, but more than 30 years ago, it played host to a very different kind of gathering. Hello, John.
You there?
You there? I'm here, yep.
Yeah, that's better. I just put you on speaker. I'm a bit deaf.
Cheers, buddy. Thanks.
I made a call to John Davidson, a former New South Wales police detective and 2IC to Kevin Parsons in this investigation. He was among the first to see the mess the thieves had left outside the main vault. What happened when they tried to get into the main vault?
They burned a hole in the top of the thermic lamp, which is pretty advanced stuff. But then they set fire to the money. So they filled it up with water so that the thermic lamps wouldn't burn the money. But the force of the blast paper mache'd all the money inside and blew it out through the cracks in the door.
It was noisy, dirty work, which attracted attention.
It's my belief that the attempt on the safe is what set off the alarm, and the security officer attended.
The alarm sounded on the Sunday morning of the long weekend. For the gang of thieves, it was a close call. While they sweated it out in the basement, the security guard entered the main banking hall of the building, one level above them, searching all the entry points. Surely his next move would be to check the vault downstairs.
He didn't go down into the basement, he only remained on the floor of the bank and was unaware that there was anybody down in the vault in the basement.
Not much of a security guard.
Well, all the entries into the bank on that level were secure. What he didn't realise was that they'd entered from an upstairs floor and got a lift down into the vault area. So he just took it that the alarm had gone off accidentally.
The press was scathing in their criticism of the bank and had plenty of questions for General Manager Arthur Sanderson.
Was there a lapse in your security at that branch?
Not that we can see at this stage.
Were any alarms triggered at all?
Yes, an alarm was triggered Sunday morning, and a guard was placed in the banking chamber on Sunday.
Do you think that they were disturbed and that's what stopped them from getting into the main vault?
That is what I think.
What gives you the indication that they were disturbed?
Well, because of all the equipment of theirs and some of the property that they had brought with them that they left behind.
The thieves left behind oxyacetylene equipment and explosives used to blow a hole in the safety deposit vault. But the gang would have required more specialised equipment for the assault on the cash vault. And it turns out they were not the first to try.
In July 1982, a gang using magnetic drills attempted to rob the same bank but fled empty-handed.
Could this be the same gang that had a crack 6 years prior? In 1988, the media were quick to speculate. They pointed the finger at the only people they regarded as capable of such a raid, the magnetic drill gang from Melbourne. There's been some intel that the magnetic drill gang led by Graham Kinnebra was approached for this job.
He was a suspect because of that information.
Graham Kinnebra's magnetic drill gang were regarded as the best safe-cracking crew in the business. They were suspected of netting over $4 million from three high-profile robberies in just 1 year.
The magnetic drill gang were being chased for many years by police in Queensland, New South Wales and Melbourne. And the job at that stage had all the hallmarks of such a professional team.
Kinnaburra's gang typically used a circular electromagnet. They would clamp it onto the side of the safe to keep the expensive diamond tip drill in place. But at the Haymarket Bank, the thieves left behind oxyacetylene cutters and explosives, giving Kevin Parsons doubts about Kinnaburra's involvement.
I think he was a cut above the ones that did this.
So could you eliminate him?
You can't eliminate anyone until you actually arrest a person for the offence. There's no way that you can just tunnel view on one suspect.
Parsons' team switched their focus to exploring a Sydney connection. And the name at the top of their list of suspects? Michael Hurley and his Friendly Gang.
Hurley's group was called the Friendly Gang. Why?
Well, they weren't friendly because, you know, they'd rob you and, you know, send you a Christmas card and a muffin basket afterwards. I mean, they were friendly with police, and they were friendly with corrupt police in particular. That's why they were called Friendly, because they were friendly with the cops.
Next, getting to know the Friendly Gang and their friends.
I could nominate one policeman who's now in jail.
Is that Roger Rogerson?
Correct.
The raid on the National Australia Bank in Sydney's Haymarket looked like a highly professional job. The thieves got away clean with the loot and had left no DNA evidence for police to work with.
I think that this had been planned over a period of months, and there would have been a number of times that they had in fact entered the vault to know exactly what was there.
Police were now focused on a Sydney connection, and they didn't have to look far to find the man with the experience and the network to pull off a heist of such magnitude. The leader of the Friendly Gang, Michael Hurley. By the 80s, Hurley was one of the kings of crime in Sydney. He'd come a long way from an impoverished background in the working class suburb of Pyrmont.
He's just a very genuine person. Aside from any colourful criminal allegations, he was just a nice bloke.
Ben Archbold was Hurley's lawyer in his later years.
My understanding is that he was born and raised in Pyrmont in a little two-bedroom house where they had seven or eight children. His mother put up with a lot from his father, and there's a lot of alcohol and substance abuse in and around that generation. There was a lot of kids shoved and pushed into a house. There wasn't a lot of food on the table, and he just had to get out and make things happen. There's some stories about Michael taking a draft horse out to Parramatta to get some chickens, come back, ride along Parramatta Road and sell them in Pyrmont. The suggestion is he didn't pay for the chickens, but in any event, he was able to provide for his family and his mother and his brother and siblings. He was a person that could get things done. From what I understand, he had no schooling. He was self-taught, taught himself how to write. But, you know, he could add up. He was a numbers man. I mean, you could give him any numbers and you could throw any numbers at him quickly, and he was able to calculate that in his head within a very short period of time.
The story goes that when Hurley was 14 years old, he faked his ID to get a job at Darling Harbour. At the time, it was a sprawling network of wharves, bond stores and railway yards, stretching from Barangaroo to Chinatown. Thefts from the Pyrmont wharves were common. It was accepted as the price of doing business. And Michael Hurley was a fast learner.
You knew Michael Hurley?
I did.
As a New South Wales police officer for over 30 years, Brian Harding witnessed Michael Hurley's rise through the crime ranks, starting at the docks.
What are the kind of stories that circulated about him and his prowess?
The story always was that he had a network of sometimes security officers on the waterfront, and they all used to feed in information to him. That's why he was so successful. And he used to steal it by the container load, not just individual items. And he'd have a storage area set up before the theft. He'd have the receivers set up before the theft. In other words, it would go very, very quickly.
Hurley's empire soon expanded. But there were missteps along the way. Like a raid on a watch store in the city, where he stole over 5,000 watches.
I think the value even then was $600,000, which, well, you can work that out to what it's worth these days.
Hurley was arrested after a tip-off and was facing a lengthy jail sentence. And that's when his connections paid dividends.
We went to trial, and the first trial was a hung jury. 11 wanted to convict, one did not want to convict, and the jury was just discharged, and we subsequently were told that the one juror that hung out had been nobbled by Michael.
Paid some money?
Yeah, actually the story was not that he received money, but he was prevailed upon through the Catholic Church that Michael and he both attended at Glebe.
For many years, Hurley was a parishioner at St James Church in Glebe, an inner city suburb near Pyrmont. He was loyal to his friends, and they were loyal to him.
He was just a very well-liked person by everyone that met him. He wasn't a very big man, he was a very small man, but he commanded a lot of respect. He just had numbers and safety in numbers. He had a good crew of people around him, and you know, because he was so nice and so generous, people wanted to help him and protect him and look after him.
Hurley's amiable nature was in evidence when he returned to court for the watch theft retrial.
While we're waiting to go into court, he confided in me that he was barely hungover. And after he left court, he said, I'm going to go and have a beer. Will you come with me? Of course, in those days, we were always encouraged to talk to them whenever they wanted to talk, and I had about 2 hours of drinking beer with him. Very likeable fellow. He didn't drop his guard. We just spoke about general things, people that we both knew, football, our support of Balmain Rugby League Club, and that was it. We parted on friendly terms, and when the fresh trial date came up, pleaded guilty.
Michael Hurley was jailed for 4 years but got out in two. He surrounded himself with a new crew in the Friendly Gang. They went into the drugs trade, which made sense because of their contacts down at the docks, which got Kevin Parsons thinking about their potential involvement in the Chinese takeaway robbery.
He was importing the drugs, which indicated he would also have the ability to export property, such as the property that was stolen from the Haymarket Bank robbery. Now, we never recovered any of that property, and I believe that somebody was able to export it overseas where it would have been melted down or disposed of over there where it wouldn't be identified.
The Friendly Gang's connections with corrupt police could have helped them to avoid detection in any number of cases.
Did you determine that Hurley had some associations with other police that might have been questionable?
Oh, I could I could nominate certainly one policeman who's now in jail, and he was put in jail by other policemen, so...
So Roger Rogerson?
Correct.
Coming up, rolling the dice with Roger Rogerson.
Rogerson, in his arrogant way, he told me, you've got 7 days to leave the country. But when Jack told me who he was, I left within 7 hours.
Michael Hurley and his friendly gang were in the frame for the great Chinese takeaway bank robbery. It's well known they were very friendly with Roger Rogerson, who left the New South Wales police force in disgrace 2 years prior to the Haymarket bank job. So it's unlikely that Rogerson helped Hurley out on that job, but it's possible he had a hand in another very famous Sydney robbery in 1980, which had Hurley's stamp all over it.
The Golconda door. It came from the Golconda mines in India in the year 1739. 2 years ago, it was bought by Angus and Coote. For the past week, it sat here in this glass display case and was the star item at a St. John's Ambulance exhibition of treasured possessions. But at about noon yesterday, thieves grabbed the jewel and replaced it with this, a worthless piece of brown glass.
The rare diamond was stolen in broad daylight at Sydney Town Hall. There were no invisible alarm beams like in the movies. Just a padlock and a hinged flap inside a small cupboard.
Here's the way they did it. Firstly, the thieves had to open the side of the display case. That was easy. Then they had to crawl under the cabinet, but before they could actually reach the diamond, they had to open a trapdoor. It was padlocked, but the thieves picked the lock and made the switch in less than 3 minutes.
The crime was a perfect fit for Hurley, taken in context with some of his earlier work.
Michael Hurley was quite supple in his body, and he'd go into a factory that they targeted, fold himself into this unbelievable position that he could fit inside a locker or a foot locker. He'd hide himself until the factory closed down, and of course, it's before modern alarms, wait until all the workers left, wait an hour or two, let himself out, let the gang in, they'd clean the place out and off they'd go.
The Golconda door snatch and grab was certainly in Hurley's skill set. There were 60 people in the room at the time, and one of the thieves even spoke to a bystander as he pocketed the gem.
One lady viewing the diamond saw a gentleman touching the diamond, and she said how beautiful the diamond was, and the gentleman said, yes, I'm just putting it back on its stand.
Michael Hurley and his brother Geoffrey were both placed at the scene of the crime. They were arrested by police, but later released without charge because witnesses could not positively identify either one of them. And as it turns out, the Hurleys weren't the only suspects.
My name is Bruce Stanton. I'm born in Leichhardt. I associated with all of the right people in Leichhardt. And my business is, years ago when I was very young and I first went to England in 1966, I got involved with an international team of jewel thieves. And that was my occupation.
Bruce flew back into Sydney the week the Golconda door went missing.
Could you have removed that stone?
I didn't even know it was there.
Oh.
No, we were actually here with another team at that particular time when that stone went missing. Another friend of mine came from New Zealand that week as well. An American, George, flew in from Hawaii. So there was four of us here.
And what do four international jewel thieves do when they arrive in town at the same time? They catch up for a drink.
That afternoon, we were in the hotel. Went up to the room, and American George was in the room. He said, it's a strange thing. He said, see that hotel opposite that building? There's a guy up there with a pair of binoculars.
The theft of the diamond was being investigated by the Special Breaking Squad. But surprisingly, Roger Rogerson, who wasn't even on the case, took an interest in Bruce being in the country.
Somehow or other, Rogerson got me confused, and my little team that was here possibly being the people to remove the stone. And when we got busted, Rogerson did take us up to the top of the police station, and he said to American George, if you don't tell me where the stone is, I'm going to throw you off the building. And that's when I said, go and fuck yourself. You know, I didn't know who he was, that he was a violent police officer. And he arrested me and locked me up, and the police cells overnight.
In the end, Bruce and his mates were released, but there was a sting in the tail.
Rogerson, in his arrogant way, he told me, you've got 7 days to leave the country. And I gave him another mouthful, still not knowing who he was. But when Jack told me who he was, I left within 7 hours.
Bruce now wonders if he and his mates were just fall guys for Hurley, known to his friends as Mickle.
Am I going too far to suggest that you might have been a convenient throw-off?
Could be. Plan B, yes. But years later, I found out that Mickle definitely was involved somewhere along the line with the stone, and that Rogerson would have been probably a partnership with it.
Given the nature of policing in New South Wales at that time, any significant robbery would require a cut and a substantial cut in cash be paid to corrupt police officers.
That's the way things were done in Sydney in 1980. And they were still being done that way in 1988 when the gang hit the bank in the Haymarket. Roger Rogerson had already left the force. So if Hurley was paying for police assistance at the time of the Chinese takeaway, you have to ask, who was on the payroll?
Next.
OK, so I really should ask you directly for the record. Did Hurley pay you off for this job in George Street? Mickle Hurley, the prime suspect for the Chinese takeaway robbery, was always said to have had police assistance. Maybe the job was a joint venture, the rumours suggested. No police were ever accused, and we make no allegations. Now, Kevin Parsons was the lead detective on this case, and John Davidson was his right-hand man. You've kept in touch with John Davidson over the years, and he knew Hurley quite well. Just can you describe their relationship?
Well, of course he knew him, because John Davidson was in that field. Special breaking detail. Some of the criminal world would like to keep him on side, and lots of people in the criminal world feared him. Now, at that stage, Mickle Hurley was a very well-known identity. They knew each other, but I can't say any more than that.
Rumours persist to this day that if Hurley did it, he must have had either an inside person at the bank or help from the police. What do you say about that sort of stuff?
Oh, it's quite possible. I was accused of helping him once by an officer from the National Crime Authority. And I said, well, I've known Mickle Hurley since 1971. He was a young cook in Glebe and I was a young cop in Glebe. But I said, if he's done something wrong, let's go and arrest him. I'll drive you over there now. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. I said, well, you're accusing me of being friendly with him or protecting him.
OK, so I really should ask you directly for the record. Did Hurley pay you off over the job in George Street, Davo?
No. I've been to lunch with him where he's paid for the lunch, but he's been to lunches where I've paid for them too. I'll grant you that most of my lunches were at the No Names restaurant, where he's sometimes with Bilson's or Prenier's.
Contemporaries of Hurley suggest that there might have been some police involvement in this.
I don't believe that for one moment. Because people see detectives talking to criminals, that doesn't mean that they're associating with them and being involved in their activities.
Kevin Parsons also knew Hurley.
What was your background with him?
We both associated in a common gymnasium that we worked out in.
In the 80s, Kevin Parsons and Mickle Hurley were members of the City Tattersalls Club in Sydney. They trained in the gym and they would cross paths from time to time, and both would use these moments to extract information from one another.
Well, I always felt it was like fencing in the Olympic Games, parry and thrust. I'd be trying to find out his knowledge and he'd be trying to find out just how much I knew about him.
But why is a bloke going to associate with you in a gym or anywhere else when he knows that your ultimate aim is to put him in jail?
Well, as I say, he's also trying to find out just how much you know of his activities. I had a coffee with Mickle on a couple of occasions. We never outwardly showed any malice towards one another.
There are strong reasons to believe Hurley was behind this bank job. He was seen near the Haymarket National Australia Bank several times before the robbery. He had Chinese connections, and it was also the scale and ingenuity of this job that indicated Hurley. The building next door was being renovated, which allowed the gang access to one of the bank's upper floors. They then went through the roof of the lift and down to the strong room and main vault in the basement. Compared to some of his earlier break and enter feats, getting in would have been a breeze. There were so many rumours about this job, Davo. Did you suspect Mickle Hurley?
Well, he never admitted to me that he did it. Mickle's really a thief, not so much a tank man. So they must have had someone with him if he did do it, of course. And as a matter of fact, I think Hurley's alibi was that he was at a Chinese gambling club the night the robbery went down. Very hard bloke to follow. If he was going to do a job, he'd leave home 3 days before it and just wouldn't go home. He was an excellent thief. He had a sixth sense. Lived his life on his elbows.
How close did you get to arresting him?
I couldn't measure it. I couldn't measure it and say how close. He was very prominent in my mind and the other investigators.
So did you ask Hurley directly? Did you do it?
No, I didn't.
So was he the one that got away?
I believe so.
Still to come. Just how big was the haul?
My estimate would be very close to 10 million.
The folklore is that there was tens of millions of dollars.
No, it never happened. Never happened. Believe me.
Mickle Hurley was never charged over the Haymarket bank job. He wasn't arrested, he wasn't even formally questioned. There was just no physical evidence tying him to this raid. However, the mail in the Sydney underworld is that the Chinese takeaway was definitely Hurley's job. In fact, it was his last major heist, as he was going deeper into a much more lucrative trade, drug importation.
From the late 80s and certainly to the 90s, he was committed to the drug trade in very substantial ways. In 1992, he'd organised a drug importation of 12 tonnes of cannabis. And the importation was to have cost him $20 million.
Hurley made a whole lot more by the time the dope hit the street. He was swimming in cash and bought a lavish house in Glebe, not far from his impoverished childhood home in Pyrmont.
The pinnacle of his life by way of real estate was a house in Toxteth Road in Glebe. Heaps of parties, just a big, impressive house, best house in the street, and that was the house that he lived in.
By now, the newspapers were calling Hurley Sydney's head honcho of crime. But if anyone asked what he did for a living, he told them. He was just a garbage collector. And a very generous one at that.
Look, there's 1,000 stories about Michael, but some of the ones that have been conveyed to me is that he went to catch a bus one day, loved buses. And he had only a $100 note, which wasn't unusual. He gave the bus driver a $100 note and the bus driver couldn't break it, so he said, keep your bus, I'll be back. He went to get a newspaper to be able to break the $100 note, but unfortunately the news agent couldn't break it, so he just turned it over and bought a whole heap of scratchies and he just shoved the bus driver a handful of scratchies. It wasn't until the next stop when the bus driver started jumping up and down that he realised he won $50,000. And he never asked for any of it back, he just said, well done, and he went about his way.
He may have been a good Samaritan in his community, but there was nothing charitable about Michael Hurley's drug dealing. In the end, he came undone when he was identified by police as the brains behind a multi-million dollar cocaine importation from South America.
The 59-year-old is accused of plotting to smuggle 30 kilograms of cocaine into Sydney with the help of corrupt Qantas workers. Federal police allege he was the controller of criminal activities amongst the baggage handlers. When the multi-million dollar drug ring was smashed, 14 men were arrested.
There was no way out for Hurley this time. Police seized millions of dollars in cash and sent him straight to jail.
Hurley appeared in court today, but he didn't look well. His lawyer said he suffers from a life-threatening illness. It's believed he's being treated for cancer.
Michael Hurley was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer and died under police guard in a hospital in 2007. He was just 61 years of age. His funeral was held in Glebe, and more than 400 mourners turned up to pay their respects. The funeral procession left the church to the strains of Frank Sinatra's My Way.
His funeral was a very big event. There was a lot of people there and one of the biggest funerals I've been to. I suppose you call it the wake or the after party. It was back at the Dunkirk Hotel in Pyrmont. There was just people hanging out of the hotel. It was a big celebration of a life of a big man. I remember at one stage an envelope getting passed around full of money. I put some money in it, obviously providing for his family or as a bit of a gift in past life, and I passed it to the next bloke who took money out of it, and the next bloke took money out of it, and the next bloke took money out of it. So I don't really understand. I thought it was money going for the family. Whether they were handing out some money because he was generous or whether it was just some greedy friends, I'm not really sure, but at the end of the day, it was a great party and a good send-off for a great bloke.
Which brings us back to the great Chinese takeaway. Was it really the biggest bank robbery in Australia? Bertie Kidd believes he's got the scoop. He shared a prison cell with Hurley just before he died.
We were just going over old things at Long Bay. He was talking about the Chinese takeaway. Naturally, you'd think the safety deposit boxes would be brimming with cash and whatever. But he told me himself, $350,000 was the total they got out of...
The total?
Yeah.
Because the folklore is that there was tens of millions of dollars...
No, it never happened. Never happened. Believe me.
He must have been bitterly disappointed.
Oh, of course. But he had no reason to lie.
Hurley may have had no reason to lie to Bertie, but according to the official account, he may have left at least one zero off the real figure.
What's your guesstimate?
My estimate would be very close to 10 million, but it was only close to 3 million that was ever reported.
Mickle Hurley is buried in Waverley Cemetery in Sydney's eastern suburbs. His grave is close to that of another Sydney crime legend, George Freeman. Freeman was more of a gangster, Hurley principally a thief. Maybe the master thief didn't get the full banquet in the Chinese takeaway. But we are still talking about that job, and to a thief, that's what matters.